Welcome to the Brown Bagger here on CFRO 102.7 FM on the wet coast of Canada. Do you feel like traveling somewhere else? No problem. Get a passport. You can travel freely. Unless you are a resident of Palestine, citizen of nowhere. Not only will you not get a passport, if you are male, you are most likely to travel to an Israeli jail. About 40% of Palestinian males have been imprisoned during the occupation of their country by Israel, according to presentations made at a conference September 27th in Vancouver, Canada. You are about to hear Charlotte Cates, a lawyer from New York City Center for Constitutional Rights, speaking about the plight of Palestinian political prisoners at the front line of resistance to illegal Israeli occupation of their land. It was recorded at SFU Harbor Center in Vancouver, Canada. Here is Charlotte Cates already addressing the all-day conference.
That when we look at the assassinations of Palestinians, from national leaders to community activists, increasingly in this intifada, what we've seen is that these assassinations haven't been taking place with guns or setups or car bombs, as has been the case in the past, but instead with missiles shot from helicopters at cars and at people on the street. And these are missiles and helicopters that are provided by, paid for, and funded and developed by the U.S. government and therefore by the taxpayers and citizens of the United States. And also, of course, the political support, the international support, the creating of entire new sort of pseudo-international institutions like the so-called quartet as a replacement for any legitimate international institutions in order to evade the question of fundamental Palestinian national rights. And that this is, you know, this is the role that we can all look at the United States and see. We can turn on the debates between John McCain and Barack Obama and see both candidates arguing that they are more concerned about the national security of the United States and the national security of Israel, which they identify as one and the same. And in fact, you know, the United States government has greatly benefited from Israel providing it with a military base, with a base of operations, and with a means of essentially a means of maintaining military control over the natural resources of the Arab people. However, you know, we all know about this kind of notorious role of the United States, but the one thing that we don't often necessarily think about is the role of the United States in both directly and indirectly maintaining the system of mass political imprisonment of Palestinian political prisoners. And that's both in the Israeli jails of the occupation and also in United States jails. Adam gave a remarkable presentation earlier about the situation of Palestinian political prisoners inside Palestine, and that's inside all of Palestine, the Palestinian political prisoners in 48 from the West Bank and from Gaza. But obviously there are also Palestinian political prisoners in exile. There are Palestinian political prisoners in Iraq, including in the jails of the occupation in Abu Ghraib and elsewhere. There are Palestinian political prisoners in Arab jails of the regimes throughout the Arab world. There are Palestinian political prisoners in the UK, probably most well-known, the case of Samer Alami and Jawad Batma. And in the United States, there have been several recent cases of political prisoners, Palestinian political prisoners, imprisoned solely for their political activity on behalf of the Palestinian people and their support for the Palestinian cause and for their own communities. And this has been these laws have been on the books that are being used against Palestinian activism for well over a decade now, and they actually came to being during the Clinton administration, and they came to being as a form of support for the so-called Oslo peace process. Because by criminalizing Palestinian activism, particularly Palestinian activism that could be designated as being linked to Palestinian political organizing in opposition to Oslo, This provided a mechanism of leverage against the Palestinian community and against the potential for Palestinians to organize against the so-called peace process that was taking place and was really a means of essentially undermining Palestinian national rights. And I'll give more details on these laws later, but it essentially involved the redesignation of Palestinian community activism as quote-unquote terrorism. And but since September 11th, since the really all-out racist assault on the Arab and Palestinian and Muslim communities in the United States, these laws have given new vitality, force, and effect. And we've seen this in the prosecution of three kind of major cases against Palestinian activists in the United States as Palestinian activists. And those are the cases of Samuel Arian and his co-defendants, of Hamad Saleh and Adahlim Ashkar in Chicago, and the case against the Holy Land Foundation. And all three of these cases have their central feature in common, which is that the defendants in all of these cases are charged with essentially the same alleged crime, which is material support to a designated, quote-unquote, foreign terrorist organization. What we saw in 1995 in the United States was the creation, really for the first time since the 1950s list of subversive organizations that was notoriously the hallmark of the McCarthy era, really at a time when groups like Consumers Union, the group that publishes Consumer Reports, were listed as dangerous organizations on an official list published by the Attorney General's office. If you're familiar with Consumer Reports, it's a magazine that rates products against each other to determine like which bathroom cleaner has the best value. And this is how far-reaching the list of subversive organizations was that became kind of a mechanism of silencing activism, suppressing movements, and destroying communities in the 1950s in the United States in the McCarthy era amid, you know, the quote-unquote Red Scare of anti-communist hysteria. And the material support laws are essentially a 21st century version of the subversive organizations list and have the same potentially devastating effects. These laws make it illegal for any person to support an organization that's been designated an FTO. And the United States State Department has total authority and the ability to do so with total discretion to designate or not designate any international organization that may be accused of basically participating in destabilizing a government as a quote-unquote foreign terrorist organization. Now, sometimes these organizations are friends of U.S. foreign policy. So, for example, we see the right-wing groups that are you know, using all kinds of weaponry to fight against the Cuban government being funded and housed and supported by the United States. But in the case of basically the vast majority of Palestinian political parties and organizations, we see them instead being criminalized. And what gets criminalized along with the actual Palestinian political parties and factions and organizations are any charities, movements, social organizations deemed to be affiliated with these organizations. And so material support essentially means raising money. But the government's argued it means more than raising money, that it could mean everything linking on a website to providing simply purely charitable support that no one argues is anything but aid to widows and orphans, to providing in the immigration and deportation context, distributing literature. And these laws essentially have led to the creation of an illegal set of organizations and activities. And given that this illegal set of organizations and activities comprises the vast majority of the spectrum of the Palestinian political scene, really the intent of these laws is perhaps less to engage in mass prosecutions than it is to engage in creating immense fear in the community at the thought that there could easily be a roundup, a bunch of mass arrests, deportations, or prosecutions if people even do so much as fundraise to break the siege of Gaza. And one of the things that's been the biggest block to grassroots community fundraising to, for example, break the siege on Gaza is the fact that people are afraid. And why are they afraid? Because the Palestinian community and the Palestinian people have been designated essentially as foreign terrorists by the U.S. State Department. But one of the things that's been really remarkable about these cases has been the government's complete failure to achieve convictions in these cases. In the case of Dr. Samuel Ariane in Florida, the U.S. government itself estimated that it spent over $80 million in the first portion of the trial to wage its prosecution. Nevertheless, Sammy's three co-defendants were completely acquitted by a jury. And Sammy himself had faced a deadlocked jury on only three counts, and the votes in the jury were 9-3 in favor of total acquittal. Sammy eventually agreed to a plea bargain in order to basically end the immense really trauma for his family that his family had been suffering since 2002 when he was first arrested. Basically agreeing that by helping his brother-in-law get a lawyer, he had engaged in a count of material support for an FTO and so therefore could be deported. However, despite the fact that he agreed to this plea bargain in order to be deported, the United States government has been attempting to continue to hold him. He was recently released on bail, which is really a great victory. It's just bail. It's just a temporary release. But that being said, the fact is that the government has been unwilling to take its hands off of Samuel Ariane for a second, 2002. And that now that there has been this release, it's a real step forward in the movement to free him. In the case of Mohamed Saleh and Abdelhalim Ashkar, who were accused of providing material support to Hamas for their own charitable work, again, you know, raising money to support widows and orphans in Palestine, they were both acquitted by the jury, and of all counts of material support, Abdelhalim Ashkar was convicted of one count of contempt of court. And he admits that he engaged in contempt of court because he refused to answer the United States government's repeated questions demanding that he give them the names of other Palestinian activists that were engaged in charitable work and activities. And I mean, it's an incredibly honorable position because there's certainly no honor in giving the U.S. government the names of Palestinian activists that were engaged in purely legal, charitable work when the government's clearly shown that it is willing, able, and ready to spend millions and millions of dollars to prosecute Palestinian community organizers for sending a few thousand dollars to Palestine. However, Abdelhalim Ashkar was sentenced by a judge to 11 years in prison for contempt of court. And this is an unheard of sentence. His lawyers are currently challenging it. And it's worth noting because when the judge sentenced him to this unheard of sentence, for which almost everyone else that's ever been convicted of only contempt of court has received 6 months to a year in prison, she noted that he was a dangerous terrorist, despite the fact that he'd just been acquitted of material support charges. In the Holy Land Foundation case, the first trial in which the U.S. government again spent an unprecedented multi-million dollar sum in order to prosecute the leading officials of what was once the largest Palestinian charity organization in the United States, they again failed to achieve any convictions, faced acquittals on most major charges, and a hung jury on several other charges. Rather than, you know, give up the attempt to try these men, they have begun a new prosecution of the Holy Land Foundation. And yesterday, in court, the government introduced a motion that it would like to introduce testimony that frequently saying Assalamu Alaikum or referring to God in wiretapped conversations are indications that one is more likely to be guilty of providing material support to terrorism, which shows really the nature of these prosecutions and that they've been based on really trying to appeal to racism. Yet despite the fact that these prosecutions have been based on an appeal to a post-September 11th racism, the fact is that American juries won't convict Palestinian community organizers of organizing in their communities, raising money to support their people, and working to free their land. And that shows that the people of the United States, despite the fact of being bombarded with media propaganda 24/7, don't accept the narrative that the United States government is telling them about Palestine, and don't accept the narrative that the corporate media is trying to sell to them. And so it's really quite remarkable that in these cases that they have not succeeded in getting any significant convictions for material support. The really dangerous part of these laws, however, isn't just the case of these particular individuals. It's what the government's trying to do on a large scale, which is to create fear in the community. Because if we look at the Palestinian, at the Palestinian people, at the Palestinian nation as a whole, the largest portion of the Palestinian nation, nearly 7 million Palestinian refugees, are outside Palestine and in exile. In countries like the United States, the Palestinian community is relatively wealthy and well off and able to help provide sustenance and support to Palestinians who are facing the most dire conditions, not only in the West Bank and Gaza, but in the refugee camps in Syria and Lebanon and elsewhere, as well as, you know, Palestinians in 48. So it's really an attempt to destabilize the Palestinian community, provoke fear, and keep people from being active by seeing these large-scale prosecutions. And in many ways, that's the purpose of laws like quote-unquote foreign terrorist organization designations and material support laws. And we're looking in Canada, there's the same kind of terrorist list. In the European Union, there's the same kind of terrorist list. And what these lists do is they essentially say that for people around the world to struggle against the interests of U.S. government foreign policy is criminal. That to be a liberation movement, to be a national liberation movement, is to engage in criminal activity. And if we look back at, for example, just the 1980s, looking at the Latin America solidarity movements, looking at the solidarity movement with the South African struggle, we can clearly see that if these same laws had existed at the time, we would see a very different list of quote-unquote foreign terrorist organizations, and the way that, you know, people engaged in solidarity in those movements would be vastly different had they had the same impact at the time. And so challenging these laws, both in a symbolic way, I mean, in Denmark recently, a group of people raised money for the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine and the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the FARC, by selling T-shirts. And they did this very publicly. And the purpose of this was to challenge Denmark's adoption of the EU list of quote-unquote terrorist organizations. And that's a struggle that's currently making its way through Denmark's courts. But to challenge these laws both through actions like the activists in Denmark did, but also by recognizing that what these laws are and what the designation of terrorist or quote-unquote terrorist organizations is an attempt to criminalize the Palestinian national movement and every movement around the world that's struggling for national liberation and against U.S. imperialism. And it's a very important struggle to take on, to fight against these laws and to fight against their existence, and also to recognize that they don't succeed. They don't succeed in criminalizing people. They don't succeed in sending people to jail. They don't succeed in convicting people before American juries. And that by massively refusing to be afraid, by going out there and raising money and sending it to the West Bank, sending it to Gaza, sending it to the camps, sending it to people who need it in order to stay on the front lines of struggle, you know, is something that we all can do and we all can be a part of, that's a direct challenge to the attempts of the United States government, the Canadian government, and the EU, both to criminalize Palestinian organizing, criminalize solidarity work, and frighten the community. Because if we can, through our own organizing, and events like this are particularly important, dealing with issues like political prisoners are particularly important in helping to shatter that fear and break the U.S. government doesn't want to spend its $80 million to engage in prosecutions and fail of every Palestinian activist in the United States. It's much better for them if they can convince us all to not be active in the first place. And that's what they want. But, you know, in reality, they're not succeeding with that, and nevertheless, they're continuing this process of of designating organizations as illegal. And Adam mentioned earlier that a lot of Palestinian prisoners are in Israeli jails or imprisoned because of the charge of belonging to an illegal organization. And so what we're essentially seeing with the material support laws is a transfer of Israeli law to become U.S. law, Canadian law, and EU law. And it's not something that any of us should stand for. But the role of the United States in keeping Palestinians imprisoned isn't just restricted to the imprisonment that Palestinians face in United States jails. On the contrary, the United States has been directly involved in the imprisonment of Palestinians in Palestine. Earlier today, we heard from Abla Sadat, the wife of Ahmad Sadat. And Ahmad Sadat is the General Secretary of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. In January 2002, he and five others were held in a Palestinian Authority prison. And they were held in a Palestinian Authority prison at the behest of the Israelis. And they were first held in a compound in Ramallah with then Palestinian Authority President Arafat, and then in April were transferred to the prison in Jericho, where they remained until March 13, 2006. But when these six men were held in Palestinian Authority prison in Jericho, they weren't held there by Palestinian guards. They were held there by United States and British guards, directly ensuring that these men would remain in prison because no Palestinian government, authority, or guard were trusted to maintain control or authority over these prisoners, and instead, they were being held under U.S. and British guard. And on March 13, 2006, when Israelis besieged the prison because after the Palestinian elections of January 2006, they no longer had any confidence that the Palestinian Authority would continue to agree to hold these prisoners at the behest of the United States and Israel, the Israelis besieged the prison and kidnapped these prisoners, and including Ahmad Sadat. And it was essentially revealed that the United States and British forces had agreed in advance with the Israelis to vacate the scene in order to allow the Israelis to besiege the prison. So it wasn't that the guards, who were allegedly supposed to protect the lives of the prisoners, were protecting the lives of the prisoners. On the contrary, they agreed with the besiegers to endanger the lives of the prisoners. And just to briefly say about the case of Ahmad Sadat, I had the opportunity to attend one session of his military trial last year when I was in Palestine with a delegation of American attorneys and activists. And everything that Adam said earlier about the military trials was true about the case of Ahmad Sadat. Now, this is a trial that's been going on with month-long interruptions between the meeting of each session. So I was attending his trial in August of 2007, and this trial is still going on today. And that's why when you look at the number of Palestinian political prisoners, over 50% have never been sentenced or even convicted because of the fact that these trials are basically complete showpieces and a mockery of justice that take place over a very extended period of time and just become a mechanism of extending detention and imprisonment. And in this case, going to the prison and going to the military court and sitting there and seeing the prosecutors yelling at Palestinian political prisoner witnesses who dared to identify themselves as Palestinian about what's Palestine, I've never heard of that, and seeing the prosecutors and judges palling around, joking and laughing with one another, really, you couldn't look at this situation, you couldn't look at this mockery of a courtroom while this, and you know, occupation soldiers walking in and out constantly, kind of with their guns thrown over their shoulders, casually walking around as Palestinian political prisoners are brought in, yelled at, and then dismissed. Really, there was nothing more to see but that this was an utter mockery of justice, an utter mockery of anything that one could really describe as a courtroom, a court of law, or a legal hearing. And it was really appalling. One would think that in the case of Ahmed Sadat, who's a national leader, well-known, a member of the Palestinian Legislative Council, general secretary of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, someone who people recognize and know, you would think that maybe they would try to cover it up a little bit, make a nicer face on this trial than they do on the trial of 11,000 political prisoners who are perhaps more nameless or faceless to people around the world. But no, it was an utter mockery of justice, an utter mockery of anything that one could consider a legal process. And I also, so to look at that case and to recognize that this is the case of a Palestinian national leader, and a case in which basically had Israel, the United States, Britain, and the forces in the Palestinian Authority that were committed to a process of security cooperation, working hand in hand with one another to directly keep a Palestinian national leader imprisoned, is something that's particularly appalling. And I also want to encourage everybody here to find out more about the campaign to free Ahmed Sadat, to learn more about the case. I'd be happy to speak with anyone more later about the details of the case. And there's a website, www.freeahmedsadat.org, and I encourage everybody to visit the website, find out more about the case, and to do more events like this to keep the case of Ahmed and the case of all of the other Palestinian political prisoners in the public eye. And just finally, as I close up, I don't want to go on too much longer, a very short time remaining, but just to say that Ahmed's case is also an illustration of one of the principles, the current push of the U.S. administration in Palestine, which is the push towards so-called security cooperation. The imprisonment and trial of Ahmed Sadat would not have been possible in the way that it happened without the participation of the Palestinian Authority in holding Ahmed Sadat and his comrades hostage for 4 years at the behest of the U.S. and the Israelis. And today, what we're looking at are U.S. generals, for example, U.S. General Keith Dayton, leading the charge to really to attempt to create an entire Palestinian security force that redefines the struggle in Palestine not as a struggle for self-determination, for return and national liberation, but instead as a question of security that is handled by developing security forces that are trained and funded and sponsored and armed by the United States, that instead of defending Palestinians and fighting for Palestinian national rights and helping to defend Palestinians every single day when Israel comes in to raid West Bank towns and cities to take more and more Palestinian prisoners, to instead serve as a security agency for Israel and participate in the political imprisonment of Palestinians. And we, you know, Abla Sadat earlier mentioned the issue of Palestinian political division, and something that the United States and Israel are very much responsible for is encouraging and fomenting political division in Palestine, so that when, you know, we're looking at political division in Palestine, this isn't just something that's happening by itself. It's something that's being encouraged, it's something that's being worked for, and it's something that's being paid for by the United States government. And it's also something, for that matter, that Canada's involved in. There have recently been a number of particularly important articles in the Israeli press that have made the U.S. agenda as far as security cooperation very clear. They'll accept nothing from Palestinians other than either complete collaboration, and the alternative is assassination or imprisonment. And these recent articles in the Israeli press have mentioned that, for example, a shipment of police batons from Canada is going through Israel to these so-called security forces that are being set up in order to create a security cooperation agreement between Palestinian Authority forces, the United States, and Israel in order to really work against Palestinian national rights. And so when we see the fact that there are a redefinition of the Palestinian national movement as instead a need for national security forces that are trained and funded by the United States, and that we can see political prisoners in Palestinian Authority jails in both Gaza and the West Bank that the need to reject security cooperation, and for us here in the U.S. and Canada, where it's our governments that are paying for and arming and funding this whole project, is particularly important. And really, the case of Ahmed Saadat is a bitter example of the end result of security cooperation. A Palestinian national leader facing imprisonment for essentially refusing the U.S. paradigm of collaboration or assassination and imprisonment. And today, there are millions of Palestinians that are also refusing this paradigm of assassination or imprisonment or collaboration, and therefore are being faced with the threat of mass imprisonment as well as assassination. Israel claims that it doesn't have the death penalty. In the past, since the beginning of this intifada 8 years ago, they've assassinated over 700 people. So clearly there, and a number of them are former prisoners. So clearly there is a death penalty that's being carried out by Israel, that's being carried out as political assassinations that, again, are trained and armed and funded by us. Again, I just wanted to thank BIAC and to thank everybody here for being a part of this discussion, for being a part of this forum, and I'm looking forward to participating in the roundtable discussion to talk about what we can do to help shut down this project of political imprisonment and what we can do here as people in the United States and people in Canada to break the participation and the role of our own governments in making this possible and in creating this paradigm of mass imprisonment. The Palestinian people and the Palestinian resistance are continuing to face this and fight this every day. And what we can do here is figure out how we can stand alongside that resistance and create resistance here in order to be able to do so as well. And this conference is a great step toward doing so. So thank you very much.
You are tuned to the Local Brown Bagger Lunch Hour program every Tuesday at noon on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. The speaker is Charlotte Cates from the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City, recorded September 27, 2008. The subject is the prisoners of Palestine.
Well, you all just heard from me for a long time, but my name is Charlotte Cates. I'm an attorney and an activist in the New York and New Jersey area in the U.S. I work for the Center for Constitutional Rights, where I'm engaged in doing education and outreach work as part of our Guantanamo Global Justice Initiative project. We're the U.S. legal organization that represents the Guantanamo detainees and coordinates the representation of the Guantanamo detainees in their lawsuits against the U.S. government, seeking hearings about their imprisonment and seeking to shut down the base. I work with New Jersey Solidarity, Activists for the Liberation of Palestine, which is a Palestine solidarity group in New Jersey, and New York, Al-Auda, the Palestine Right to Return Coalition, which is an organization focused on organizing the Palestinian community and solidarity activists to struggle for and in support of the right to return of Palestinian refugees.
Hi, my name is Gordon Murray, and I've been to Palestine twice with the International Solidarity Movement. Went there as a human rights monitor and to see what was happening on the ground and support Palestinians in their daily struggle for life, whether it's picking olives in their trees or getting to school, getting food, and so on, which is constantly being thwarted by the Israeli military and the checkpoint system. As I mentioned, there's over 600 checkpoints in the West Bank alone, which is, I'm sure it's much smaller than Vancouver Island. It's a tiny area. So basically, you couldn't go more than what would be here a few blocks without passing a checkpoint. And I'm also involved with the Boycott Israeli Apartheid campaign here in Vancouver, which is the group that's putting on this event, this conference, or helped organize the conference. And previously, we've also been involved in organizing a boycott of chapters here locally, and also we helped organize the Walk for Palestine to commemorate 60 years of Nakba and 60 years of Israeli ethnic cleansing last May. So Bayat is active, and we're thrilled to be involved in this conference and look forward to more participation from people here.
Okay, so I guess now we'll just open it up if people have questions and comments, and hopefully we can try to just get a conversation going.
Well, I just had a question after hearing you speak, Charlotte. Isn't there some sort of legal case for a lawsuit against the U.S. government for malicious prosecution?
That it would be difficult to make. I mean, in the cases of Samuel Ariane and the other defendants in these cases, I mean, the real problem are these laws that exist in the first place, because the government can basically always claim that it had a good faith basis to believe that their charitable work was connected to some Palestinian political organization or another, and therefore, I mean, because when we're talking about, for example, sending money to Palestine, you know, that they'll be able to try to kind of look for, if they want to justify it, you know, the most abstract connection, the fact that someone who worked in an office was also a member of an organization or some kind of, you know, connections of this type in order to justify. So therefore, you know, it totally makes sense that this is basically funding a designated entity or organization. And the real problem is the fact that these laws exist that designate political organizations and liberation movements as quote-unquote foreign terrorist organizations. As long as these kinds of laws are on the books, there's always the potential for these kinds of prosecutions to take place. And by shutting down by really working to campaign to end the designations and to end the quote-unquote terrorist list, we have a much greater potential of really stopping any of these kinds of prosecutions from going forward by exposing the fact that these laws themselves are racist and invalid and based on essentially criminalizing association. And there is a fair constitutional case for that, and just to be said that in another case, the Center for Constitutional Rights Humanitarian Law Project cases is pursuing various challenges to the material support statutes as they stand. And some of the provisions, for example, the idea that providing merely teaching support or, for example, medical support would be considered material support under the Patriot Act, those provisions currently are considered invalid because of this lawsuit. So there are definitely legal challenges to the material support laws that exist.
I just wanted to also emphasize, like, for those of us that are here, like in Canada or in the United States, that the internal political division in Palestine is being supported and funded and promoted by our governments. And so one of the biggest things that we can do to help support Palestinian national unity is to do what we can both to expose that role, to protest against it, and to stand in support of, you know, of Palestinian people's right to self-determination and to the national kind of constants of the Palestinian people, to end the occupation, to achieve the right to return, to achieve self-determination, and the struggle for liberation. And I know that sounds very, like, general and very broad, but in reality, you know, a lot of the Palestinian political division, if it were not for the constant intervention of Israel and the United States into Palestinian politics, simply would not be the case. And when we look at the fact that here in 2008, we're looking at 15 years after the signing of the Oslo Accords, of the Oslo Agreement, and we're looking at a process that was basically done outside the auspices of real international legitimacy, again with the creation of these international substitute negotiations by the United States. And when we look today at the situation of political division, we're looking at the fruits of the so-called peace process, which is to try to obtain quote-unquote peace for the occupation at the expense of the occupied people. And at the expense of the occupied people has meant the promotion of division, has meant the promotion of conflict, and doing anything possible to undermine the movement in the Palestinian people as a whole that's calling for national unity around the core Palestinian principles of the national movement.
And so what we can do, I mean, for those of us, I mean, for Palestinians that are organizing in their community, organizing here in unity is very important. And for those of us that are doing solidarity work, organizing against the policies of our own government is the best way that we can act to support Palestinian national unity and help to promote Palestinian national unity by providing an environment to try to stop the involvement of all of our governments in creating disunity and division. I'm not familiar with the particular corporation in general. I know that there certainly has been, there have been several campaigns to prepare for various kinds of litigation against the manufacturers of cluster bombs, which often have a look that kind of looks like a kind of a ball type thing that people might bat between them. And there have been, and of course, which were known for causing so much destruction in Lebanon in 2006, and that there have been, you know, various kinds of litigation against the against various manufacturers, weapons manufacturers. In the 1980s, there was a lawsuit against Federal Laboratories for its manufacture and sale of tear gas to Israel, and it was used against Palestinians in the First Intifada. And that lawsuit actually ended with a settlement. And there are other lawsuits that are being pursued. I mean, in addition to the one that Adam mentioned in Canadian courts, there are also other corporate lawsuits, for example, against Caterpillar for its role in selling bulldozers that are used to destroy Palestinian homes and have killed Palestinians as well as international activists like Rachel Corrie. There have been various uses of the courts in this regard. In regard to Omar Khadr's case, just to note very briefly, that his military commission, which are these sort of military tribunals that have been set up by the United States at Guantanamo in order to kind of give a specter of legitimacy to this process of creating an offshore prison camp where people are rounded up from around the world and thrown into indefinite detention, his military commission has been postponed to take place beginning on November 10th to allow basically the U.S. elections time to finish before it continues. And it's particularly important to note in Omar Khadr's case that so far the military commission has rejected the petition of a UN expert on child soldiers to attend the hearing and has refused to recognize the fact that at the very least he should be classified as a child soldier or prisoner, given the fact that he was 15 when he was captured. So we're going to be looking very, and he does have a very active defense team and a very active legal team both in the United States and Canada. And at CCR, we're certainly going to be looking very closely at his case and particularly its impact for the future of young people and children that are being prosecuted in this U.S. military commission system, which is, it's not dissimilar to the use of the Israeli military, you know, so-called justice, really military injustice system against Palestinian children as well. And Omar Khadr is actually not the only juvenile. There are many other juveniles that were held at Guantanamo. Many of them were released without ever being charged after losing years of their lives to seemingly at the time endless and arbitrary detention and imprisonment. And one of the other young men facing a military commission, Muhammad Jawad, was also 17 when he was picked up by the United States. So there are several of these cases of young people and children, legal children, facing military commissions. And so once again, we're really seeing the parallels between the military injustice system that's used by the occupiers in Palestine and the military injustice system that's being used by the occupiers in Afghanistan and Iraq. Just to mention briefly about the use of universal jurisdiction and other kinds of similar principles against Israeli war criminals. In the United States, again, in order for there to be an actual prosecution, this is something that would have to be agreed to be prosecuted by the U.S. government, and the U.S. government has no interest in prosecuting Israeli war criminals who enter U.S. territory. I mean, as Adam pointed out, law is not neutral. Law is related to power, and they can't be taken. You can't look at law in the abstract and divorce it from its context of power. It's why we talk about the material support laws. The problem is the designations itself. It's not that the wrong people are making the designations or that they're being biased. In the system that currently exists in the United States, the only solution to the designation of organizations as terrorist organizations is to end the designations and end the laws, because the United States government is always going to use it and to use it in exactly the way it does now. That being said, there have been, as in the UK and elsewhere in Europe, there have been complaints pursued in France and Germany against also U.S. war criminals, for example, Donald Rumsfeld and others, that have reached that. To this point, we have not found a public prosecutor that is actually willing to sign the warrants in these cases, but they have delayed and postponed the actual trips of Donald Rumsfeld and several other U.S. officials. In the United States, there are civil lawsuits against Avi Dichter and Moshe Yaalon for their participation in war crimes, specifically in the case of the assassination of Salah Shahada, in which a one-ton bomb was dropped on an apartment building in the center of Gaza, killing its intended target and many other people, and as well as the bombing of Khama in Lebanon. And those are two cases that are currently being pursued in U.S. courts by people who were victims of these two massacres, who are suing these Israeli war criminals in U.S. courts. And right now, those cases are still proceeding through the courts, so there is some potential of actually getting a hearing on this. But again, as Adam was saying, the courts are not neutral, and the U.S. government itself has actually intervened in these cases in support of the position of the Israeli war criminals that they should have immunity for acts that they committed as government officials. Oftentimes, you know, a lot of times when we're doing, you know, solidarity work or whatever, there's a strong emphasis on, well, you know, we need to hear both sides. And again, I mean, like Adam said, there are anti-Zionists that are, you know, because the question isn't, you know, the question isn't whether there are Israelis that want to be nicer to Palestinians, who think that Palestinians should have less difficulty or that there should be fewer restrictions on movement. I mean, all of these things are incremental activities and may, you know, even provide some benefit in some limited sense. However, you know, the question is that of self-determination and national liberation. And as long as Palestinians are being denied self-determination and national liberation, then there is, you know, there's no way to really oppose what Israel is doing without negating, you know, without negating Zionism. And Zionism is a racist movement that's based on the expropriation of Palestinian land from Palestinian people and the creation of a settler colonial state that is purely based on racism, occupation, and oppression of Palestinians. And so it isn't necessarily a struggle to make the occupation nicer. Not that this is what the people that you were doing, that you were meeting, were saying, but that there are a lot of, you know, so-called Israeli peace groups that essentially have a goal of making a nicer occupation, or an occupation on 78% of Palestine instead of 22%. And as Adam said, refusing to recognize the right of return and refusing to recognize that, you know, there are 7 million Palestinian refugees around the world that have a right to return to their original homes and lands and properties. And that in the end, I mean, the liberation of the Palestinian people and the liberation of Palestinian land is, I mean, essentially a liberation of Jews from Zionism, from this ideology that's based on racism and oppression and exploitation. And that, you know, as solidarity activists, that would, we have the potential to amplify Palestinian voices here in Canada and here in the United States and what voices are saying there, and that we shouldn't feel that we have to necessarily balance what we're saying by looking at what the other side is, quote unquote, the other side is saying, but say this is a struggle for liberation, this is a struggle for justice, and all of those people, including anti-Zionists and those that refuse that refuse a racist state and refuse a settler state and refuse colonialism, are part of, you know, of standing for the liberation of Palestine, and that, you know, people of all backgrounds and all national backgrounds. But the state of Israel itself is in fact the problem, and it's the nature of the state of Israel that leads to political imprisonment that we've talked about today, and to all of the crimes that we've seen today. And when there are those, like Pathé and others, that stand against that, it can be very powerful and very strong. You know, it cannot be denied that this is not the strongest time for the Arab left in its history, and that if we look back at if we look to you know, the era of Nasser, if we look to the era of the strongest point of Arab nationalism, that is a history, though, that's not just consigned to failure. There have certainly been problems, and there have certainly been, this is not a high point for the Arab left, but the fundamental nature of the struggle in the Arab world for Arab liberation, as well as for the liberation of Palestine as part of Arab liberation, is not, you know, the nature didn't change just because there was really a massive repression also against, really massive repression against the Arab national movement and an international crisis of the left. I mean, we can all look at the last, you know, since 1991 and look at what happened internationally. And we can look right now, for example, in Latin America. In many ways, even the Latin American left, which was quite strong, was seen as failing or very much in crisis. The most major countries in Latin America were deeply indebted to the World Bank austerity proposals. And now when we look at Latin America, we're seeing in Venezuela, in Bolivia, and elsewhere, really a new rise of both the reclaiming of natural resources and the reclaiming of national resources, and of really an international pan-Latin American movement that is a true challenge to U.S. imperialism. And it's certainly the case that the Arab people right now are suffering from regimes that are not, in many cases, representing the best interests of the Arab people or representing the interests of the Arab people at all. On the contrary, when there's an international trend toward the reclamation of natural resources, these regimes are by and large cooperating with the United States' desire to control those resources and oppress their own people in that interest instead. But simply because the Arab left is not in a strong point at the present time doesn't mean that it's a failed movement or a failed cause, because the struggle is continuing. And I mean, in Palestine, certainly there continue to be leftist parties and programs and movements. I mean, we've just been talking about the case of Ahmed Saadat, who's the General Secretary of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which is an active leftist party that certainly doesn't have the numbers that it had in, say, the late 1960s or the early 1970s, but continues to play an active role in all forms of resistance against the occupation and in all forms of resistance against colonialism and injustice. And that the Arab people have an immense capacity, and I'm sure we all are, that the Arab people have immense capacity to reinvent their movements and themselves to answer the call of reality. And so when we look at the potential for an emerging movement in the Arab world, that there is vast potential there, and that what we can do is to support that potential, not because it's what we'd like to see the movement look like, but because it's inevitable. And to look at, for example, what's happening in Palestine and look at the role of U.S. imperialism in Palestine and in the Arab world, and struggle to fight U.S. imperialism in the Arab world hand in hand with the national liberation movement that's doing that work on the front lines. Because it isn't going to, our conferences like this here are incredibly important, but the real victory is going to be won by the resistance and the struggle of the Palestinian people and of the Arab people. And conferences like this are a part of figuring out how we can best strategize to support that resistance. And discussions like this are an incredibly important part of that.
That was Charlotte Cates for the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City, recorded September 27, 2008. It was an all-day conference in solidarity for Palestinian political prisoners at the front line of resistance to illegal Israeli occupation of their land. It was recorded at SFU Harbor Center in Vancouver, Canada, for the local Brown Bagger on CFRO 102.7 FM Co-op Radio. Tune in every Tuesday at noon for the best of Vancouver speeches.
الوادي قامت تعجن في البدرية وديك بيدن كوكو كوكو
We'll be right back. الحب وقالك وعالدرب